A Very Good American Novel, H. L. Davis's Honey and the Horn, first published in Tin House, 2013. Writers west of the Mississippi are up against the Eastern notion that everything west of the Mississippi, except maybe Stanford, is cactus. Many Easterners also hold that regional fiction is inferior and that a region is anywhere that isn't the East. You can't beat logic like that. It's amazing that H.L. Davis of Oregon won a Pulitzer, even in 1936. Lately, however, he's been so neglected, so lost to literature, that readers may be startled to recognize in his style and tone a model for Ken Kesey in Sometimes a Great Notion, Don Barry in Trask, and most other serious novelists of the West, including even the high-toned Wallace Stegner. Molly Gloss in The Jump Off Creek and The Hearts of Horses is his true heir, the one I think he might have acknowledged as getting it pretty near all the way right. Davis's prize-winning masterpiece was Honey and the Horn. Its protagonist, Clay, is a likable, mule-headed, mixed-up boy of 18 or so who has already been through a good deal but hasn't yet shut down in self-defense. His instincts are decent, but he falls in with an unlawful posse and takes enthusiastic part in hunting down and lynching his own worthless father, who might only be his uncle. His girl, Luce, the most vivid character in the book, is a wonderful mixture of forthright honesty and wary elusiveness. It's a good love story, always balanced on the high wire between possibility and tragedy. Clay and Luce are both quite capable of murder, which keeps the tension up. Both are ignorant, intelligent, young but already damaged, haunted by bad mistakes, pursued by past darkness, yet struggling to find a moral sense in the huge complexity of life. Of the wildly various people they meet or travel with, some have sunk contentedly into crime, many into futility, some are merely restless, and some, like Clay and Luce, keep groping vaguely toward a clearer standard, a better way to live, maybe just over those mountains there. Clay takes a lively interest in the world, and through him, in a deceptively easygoing style, Davis gives us his own stunningly vivid perceptions of people and places. Here we're riding with Clay across a hard-pan desert. In the big stretches, the alkali reflected the exact dark blue of the sky, and that parted to right and left as he rode into it, so that he rode with the sky rubbing either elbow and washing softly back from the mare's feet as she advanced. There were places where spots in the clear air expanded with heat and magnified distant sections of scenery so they seemed only a few feet away. And then they would go on expanding till they got gigantic, until a couple of sage rats cutting grass would look as big as colts, and then they would vanish as if they had been dissolved in water. Davis was a generous, cross-grained man who drank too much, as journalists and male novelists were expected to do. He wrote several fine novels and stories, including the unforgettable Open Winter, all of them about the Oregon country and the people who worked in it. He said he wanted Honey and the Horn to contain an example of every job people did in Oregon in 1912. That statement itself takes us back to a faraway world of hard, skilled, physical, and infinitely various work, such as cowboying, or blacksmithing, or cooking for ranch hands, or fishing for salmon by dangling off a rope in a waterfall with a gaff in hand, or sewing grain sacks shut. The novel was written during the Great Depression, when work was something very much on people's minds. The time it describes is now a century ago. Given the rate of technological change, it's been the longest 100 years in human history. To some, Davis's picture will be meaningless. To others, fascinating. In any case, it's worth considering that from the beginning of human culture until a generation or two ago, everybody lived in the work world he describes, and it won't take much to put us back into it. For all its vivid, vigorous language, its dry, teasing humor, its grand scenery indicated by a few easy strokes, and its crowd of cantankerous characters noisily causing trouble for themselves and everybody else, clear across two mountain ranges, the essential feeling the book leaves me with is loneliness. Or what I think of as the American version of the word, lonesomeness. Lonesome people. That could be a strike against it. We may adulate the lone hero, but we don't want to be him. Lonesomeness is what the ever-present TV and cell phone and social media save us from. All the same, it's what a lot of people in the West came looking for. Room, space, silence. We're social animals, but we crave solitude to make our souls. Americans cherish their opinions at least as much as their souls, and opinions allowed to take root where nobody's around to crowd them grow great and very strange. Davis takes a good deal of pleasure describing them. He had some strong opinions of his own, including a low one of developers, the people who turned the West into desirable real estate, filled alkali flats with little white stakes marking out unbuilt avenues and opera houses, and fooled the hopeful with talk of 10-foot topsoil, railroads certain to come, fortunes to be made, orange orchards in the sagebrush. Developers are loyal, active servants of capitalism, of course. Possibly that explains his opinion of them. The kind of super-respectful language used today when speaking of non-white peoples, language that white racists label political correctness, was as unknown to Davis as it was to Shakespeare. He treats everybody exactly alike. Nobody gets any respect from him who hasn't individually earned it. He speaks of Native Americans not across a gulf of wishful thinking, but from a personal knowledge of difference so rare in fiction that it will shock people these days. And may be part of the reason why Honey and the Horn has been dropped from the canon. The many Indian groups are clearly vividly differentiated. In a sketch of a coastal village, he describes a tiny isolated group of Athabascans. There was a kind of hopelessness about that lost tag end of a great people, stuck off in such a place without anything to use their brains on if any of them ever developed any, with nothing that they could ever amount to except to become chief of a shack town containing maybe 6 dozen human beings, with strange people and strange languages all around them, so that there could be no chance of ever getting away. Not that there was anything mournful about it. They didn't want to get away, and they had stayed where they were for pretty close to 1,000 years without the slightest suspicion that any place in the world could be finer or more interesting than their own 20 acres of it. Davis omits the probability that this village, like many on the Oregon coast, had recently lost 80 or 90% of its people to white diseases. And he was a desert man who couldn't imagine liking the rainy coast. Otherwise, he mocks these people only as he mocks everybody. His picture of white settlers near this Indian village is just as unsparing. Disrespectful of conventional pieties, but fascinated by and respectful of cultural difference, Davis can feel sympathy with the Indians without feeling obliged to share their view of life. What's more, he knows that his judgment of it is immaterial. Such fair-minded plain-speaking is too easily silenced by the emotional rant of racism, anti-racism. When Huckleberry Finn is banned, calumniated, and bowdlerized for using the word nigger, despite the fact that nigger Jim is the moral hero of the book, how can any lesser book survive? For all their failure to attain any goal or even do anything that makes much sense, the book's characters are fiery with life. Absurdly tragic, painfully funny, ornery as all get out. Through the grand indifference of the Oregon landscape, Davis sends a cavalcade of mavericks and loners, a crazy symphony of dissenting voices, a pilgrimage of obdurate souls. In them, with some reluctance, with some relief and even delight, I see my countrymen as they can be seen only from the farthest west, the farthest stretch of the extraordinary American experiment in how to be human.